Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin with your wake-up call from Singapore on this 21st day of May in the year of our Lord, 2012. Well, before we proceed apace, I should inform you that the great and wonderful stock Facebook is down $4.50 today, which of course means it's broken its syndicate price of $38, being down as it is to 33 and change. This is par for the course, ladies and gentlemen, a ridiculous stock for a company which has nothing going for it except, you know, a pimply 28-year-old who basically came into some money, to put it mildly. I think, in retrospect, people will look back on Facebook as the announcement of the greatest bear market in the history of the world. I think Facebook itself will go way below $3 a share, probably even under a dollar a share before all this is over. The market itself, as I think you know, will probably lose about 95% of its value. But it's kind of interesting how the markets make moves and have seminal changes based on important fundamental markers. Like, for example, last year, what I call Osama bin Laden's death day, which was the 2nd of May, heralded in the beginning of a bear market at that point, which has largely not been exceeded to this day. You know, they managed to kill bin Laden and kill the stock market at the same time, which is perhaps not the intended outcome, but certainly is what happened. Well, last week I mentioned how the American Social Security system was originally set up in the 1930s when there were 13 workers supporting each retiree. Now, as I said, today there are only 3 workers supporting each retiree. And we need to talk a little more about this because in Europe the problem is even more acute. France has a particular problem because its European-style social safety net, which is basically transfer payments, is more institutionalized than in many other nations. And as a result, only 56% of the French working age population is actually in the labor force, either employed or looking for work, as compared to 60% in Germany, 64% in the United States, and 67% in Canada. And these figures come courtesy of the World Bank. So the situation is that only a little more than half of France's working age population is working or seeking work, while there is a building demographic crisis with fewer young French workers to support each French retiree, and a new French president was just elected on a promise of lowering the retirement age from 62 down to 60 years old. Well, apart from this being insanity incarnate, from an economics perspective, this is amazing stuff. For decades, politicians in Europe, as well as in the United States and other nations, has been getting elected by making impossible promises about the future and retirement. The 1-to-2 combination of declining fertility rates and growing retirement promises created an oncoming cliff that has been in plain sight for decades now, for those who cared to look. However, as long as it was comfortably far off in the future, few people really worried about it, not while there was political advantage to be gained today by making promises that a different generation of politicians would have to eventually deal with. A shorthand way of describing the current Eurozone crisis is that the cliff is no longer in the distance. It is no longer 5 years away, but it is in clear view here and now. There is more to the cliff than retirement ages, as expensive promises have been made in many ways. But the core of the Eurozone debt crisis is that nation after nation is finding out they've crossed the line in the here and now and can't pay for the politically popular promises they made to themselves. While austerity was effectively saying, let's slam on the brakes, the platform of François Hollande campaigned upon was, let's put the pedal to the metal instead and accelerate towards the cliff. And he won the election. For a guide to the toxic intersection between dysfunctional politics and extraordinary deficits, one need look no further than the US government. Short-sighted, partisan bickering and power plays entirely unnecessarily placed the United States in danger of defaulting on its debt in 2011. These same dysfunctional politics created the looming fiscal cliff for the U.S. government at the end of 2012 that could crash the economy, send taxes soaring, or even both. There is no reason for this arbitrary solve or self-destruct deadline for the U.S., except that the political leadership agreed that because partisan differences between the two sides couldn't be solved, even in the name of preventing national bankruptcy, the best so-called solution was to defer but force a later solution through creating an artificial deadline with severe risks for the nation. Europe just became the United States. There is effectively a co-presidency between Germany and France when it comes to the debt crisis. And there is now a split government with the co-presidents belonging to opposing parties. This means that the chances of finding a solution in the midst of crisis just diminished markedly. There were, of course, many issues driving the election results in France, and not everything was economic. But the ending bottom line was that the leader talking about making tough choices became personally unemployed himself, and the leader who told the people exactly what they wanted to hear is now in power. At the same time, politicians advocating fiscal responsibility were also voted out of office in Greece and Italy. This was all carefully noted in Washington, D.C., Berlin, London, Canberra, Ottawa, and many other capitals. Citizens in France and elsewhere will get exactly what they demanded from those they voted into office. Glowing promises on the surface, which are impossible to keep in substance over the longer term, which then require deep levels of deception beneath the surface that steadily break the impossible promises in a manner that is sufficiently complex that the average voter will never really understand what is going on. I think I need to clarify my point about the rising dollar, by the way. Everyone seems to fall into the trap of believing that America's dire economic situation means that the dollar must collapse. actually its dire economic situation means that the dollar must soar. This is because an all-out collapse right now is more imminent in Europe than in the U.S., with the political leadership I just talked about being divided. All it takes is the combination of one flashpoint combined with one bad political decision, and the Eurozone could go down at any time. This would be highly likely to lead to a soaring U.S. dollar, which could devastate an already fragile and enfeebled U.S. employment and economy. This, in turn, could create a tidal wave slamming into Canada, Australia, and other nations which trade heavily with both Europe and the United States. Rising dollars make for cheaper imports, which emphasize the deflation I've been talking about. This is the nightmare of being hitched to the world's reserve currency, a currency which prices the rest of the world out of its markets and causes a huge drop in the employment of workers engaged in the export market. Welcome to the United States of America. All this, of course, is going to exacerbate the current depression that nobody is talking about. All this leads to economic collapse worldwide, which brings us back to the horror of a broken derivatives market, which I've probably spoken enough about in recent shows. Suffice it to say that this will lead to the inevitable consequences of an already bankrupt financial system. Not a pretty picture, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so with that, let me divulge my information as follows. My name is Richard Martin. The toll-free number is 888-874-4888. The email address, in case you would prefer to communicate that away, is rm@gfawd.com, which is Richard Martin, RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once again, if you want to write in, it is rm@gfawd.com. And my personal number, contact the direct number if you want to call me in private. You may do so at area code 941, that's in Sarasota, Florida, 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right, well, I have received some feedback this morning about yesterday's meetup group from Jack Chavesta. And this is what he had to say. He says, Richard, I am happy to report that this month's wake-up call went very well. Two people were there for the first time. They came from Connecticut and Rochester, New York. The person from Rochester drove 7 hours to get to the meeting. He was exhausted, but relieved that he was with like-minded people. Two other people present were from the original group started by Lewis. I was able to connect with Susan and Brian via Skype. Everyone had a lot to talk about. We spoke about how we deal with the psychological aspect of facing and dealing with reality when most people refuse to acknowledge it or prefer to treat the events taking place throughout the world as small, trivial matters. We also exchanged useful information on pensions and other financial options. Susan covered some very interesting information from a book written by John Perkins concerning the devaluation of Ecuador's currency, which forced large numbers of residents to leave the country and the transition to using U.S. currency. She also elaborated on the video you sent to your subscribers regarding the dire and desperate situation in Greece. I did go over some resources for learning foreign languages, but that was the last topic covered since everyone had so much to say. I completely forgot to check with the staff at the Ale House to confirm for the next meeting on June the 24th, 2012. I will get back to you on that, Jack Trivesta. Thank you very, very much, Jack, and thank you for what you have done and the effort that you went to in order to make such a successful meetup. And I'm sure everybody is looking forward to the next meetup on the 24th of June. We will almost certainly, I think, have it in the Ale House again. They don't usually make trouble for us, so I imagine that we shall be able to use their premises. But when Jack lets me know for sure, I will let you know for sure. In the meantime, I myself have a little information for you about learning languages, or rather the teaching of English as a foreign language to people. I happened to be on a website, quite by chance, dealing with Thailand the other day, and there was a website devoted to the teaching of English as a foreign language to Thai people, and there was a job forum within that website, and I just clicked on it. And ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ads for English teachers wanting to teach English in Thailand. Now, I am, of course, extremely encouraged by this, because I do believe that Thailand is an ideal country for people to emigrate to. The people are extremely friendly. They're very pleasant. It costs about a fifth to live in Thailand of what it does in the United States. You can receive your Social Security, any other kind of payments in the very efficient Thai banks. It takes about a month to 6 weeks, apparently, to bone up for the exam, the teaching of English as a foreign language, the TEFL exam, with which you can then go out and teach English in Thailand, both to official schools and also to private language schools, to people privately. Apparently, you can get a lot of business privately teaching English. It's really not difficult, and the wonderful thing about teaching English is that you don't actually have to speak the mother tongue. It's not necessary to speak Thai in order to teach English as a foreign language. Basically, it can be done. You simply point to a table and say, table in the case of French, or tish in the case of German, I don't know what it is in Thai, but you point to yourself and you say, I, you know, and then you say, I am a man. And, you know, in the end, these people get it. I mean, I know it sounds primitive and crude, but I assure you, it's the best way of learning a language. In other words, to imitate the way you yourselves learn a language as a child. And it is very effective, much, much more effective than the old traditional method of taking a book and translating word for word and expression for expression from one language into another. It doesn't work. Language is not freely translatable from one language to another. And they discovered this about 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, that it didn't really work to teach English like that. And those who adopted the new method, the audio-visual method, where you really visualize what you're seeing, you visualize a table, you visualize a chair, and you say that word in the new language, and you force yourself out of your own language, that is the way to learn. And that's the way they teach today. So you don't need the use of a foreign language. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you are of a mind to emigrate, and you want to go to, you have an idea to go to Thailand, please note that there's plenty of work as of Saturday night in Thailand teaching English. So there you are. I give it to you straight. Okay, well, I thought I'd give you a little piece of a blogger's mind. It's a blogger that I follow, and it's about Michelle Caruso Cabrera, who's one of the hosts on CNBC. And this is pretty pithy stuff. I mean, there's no foul language or anything like that. But this is the kind of direct talk that you get when you actually go online and you read about people who are very knowledgeable, actually. In many cases, I think more knowledgeable than the people they're writing about. Michelle Caruso Cabrera happened to be on the panel at the Bill Maher show this week. And so I thought it was kind of interesting that to bring this information to you. If anybody happened to have seen Bill Maher this week, you will remember Michelle Caruso Cabrera. So, and this is somebody who got it wrong. And the blogger points this out in no uncertain terms. So this is what he has to say. And remember, this is a woman who was supportive of the efforts of J.P. Morgan's trader and defending him and his unfortunate trade gone wrong. So here we have a blogger about Michelle Caruso Cabrera. MCC, you are an idiot, an absolute, complete, utter buffoon. You have no concept of what banking is all about, nor any idea of what the JPM hedge was. If you cannot speak intelligently about the IG9 10-year synthetic CDX index and what JPM was attempting to do with it, which you clearly cannot, then you should keep your pie hole stapled shut. In addition, it was clear from your comments Friday that you have no idea what hedging risk means, and you are of the delusion that all risk is of the same type. Please be informed that the kind of hedge that two sides of a trade can do in, for example, corn, farmers versus cereal makers, is completely different from the nature of risk financial companies attempt to do. And by the way, in passing, ladies and gentlemen, let me explain. I did mention the difference in my last show when talking about derivatives, so you will know exactly what this blogger is talking about. To continue. The ignorantly arrogant drivel you put toward your one rational guest on Friday reminded what few viewers your network has left that the talent, so-called, was not hired for their intellectual insight. In your particular case, one is hard-pressed to determine what the network had or has in mind by employing you. There are a lot of boobs in the world, and I use that term both literally and euphemistically. Some risks cannot be hedged. These risks are merely passed around like an old maid until they land in the lap of the dumbest, most arrogant, or most well-connected institution. Think AIG. For a completely different insight, and to better understand what your guest was attempting to say in the face of your ignorant arrogance, think insurance company. They charge a premium rates that factor in the assumption of a certain number of payouts. Old-time responsible banks, before the obfuscation of prop trading in deposit-taking institutions, used to both know their borrowers and charge loan rates that factored in a certain amount of loans gone bad. That is also why banks hold loan loss reserves, you moron. If globalization means that our major banks lose out to banks who would make more aggressive lending or financial promises, so be it. Wouldn't we all have been better off if it had been HSBC or Swiss Re that had Joe Cassano's group in its employ? Yes, some hedging needs have changed since the days of James Stillman and Citibank, but only some. Don't cut JPM so much slack. Part of the unlearned legacy from the financial crisis is that not all risk can be hedged. The risk doesn't go away. It merely gets shifted, obfuscated, and convoluted until it bites the biggest fool, which unfortunately has turned out to be the U.S. taxpayer. If you have the ability to do some simple math and be realistic at the same time, and not an ignorant knee-jerk mouthpiece for your betters in the financial industry, consider this. JPM holds $1.1 trillion of customer deposits, which represents about 9% of the total U.S. banking system deposit base. They have about $720 billion in loans outstanding, which raises another point about the need, or lack thereof, for more QE, as the system is hardly hobbled for lack of liquidity. The $400 billion difference is used for prop trading, even if the euphemism used by JPM's bean counters is cash management. Getting back to the IG9 index, which JPM's whales, Bruno Ixil and Achilles Macris in London, traded, this was more prop trading than hedge. And the degree which these two tried to monopolize that synthetic index reeks of desperation trying to double down on a trade gone bad. Think Nick Leeson and not Nebraska corn farmer. Now for the kicker. Try to get your addled brain around this. J.P. Morgan has $60 trillion of derivatives outstanding. That's 60000000000, which is approximately the GDP of the planet Earth in 1 year. Now, don't go saying that's gross notional, not net notional, because the gross notional on the IG9 position was only $200 billion. In other words, given the at least $2 billion loss, and it may end up being twice that, then JPM is looking at a 1% loss on the gross notional amount of what was supposedly a hedge. That should scare the bejesus out of any sane and intelligent person, which means you may well remain unaffected. Ixil and Macris were considered JPM's top risk traders. Cutting JPM some slack, what if the firm's other traders are at least equally skilled at running risk and can be expected to form as well as Ixil and Macris? What's a 1% loss on gross notional value of an $80 trillion derivatives book? Do you think J.P. Morgan has that kind of money? Are you such a butt-licking sycophant of the financial industry that you think it is prudent for the custodian of 9% of the U.S. deposit base to assume risk positions equal to the GDP of the planet? Can you not see that those who fail to be punished by history are condemned to repeat it? They'll not necessarily pay for it. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly the kind of talk that we need to hear on CNBC, you know, in rebuttal against these crazy hosts who are just there basically to support their employers. That's all they do for a living, quite honestly. And it does indeed explain why CNBC is losing viewers faster than water off a duck's back. You know, right now, this J.P. Morgan deal is getting much worse. I'm hearing that it is in the region of $6 to $7 billion, a far cry from the $2 billion that we were told about last week. Now, I've no idea whether this is real, whether this is true. It's exaggerated. I set no store by any kind of figure that I'm reading right now. We will, in due course, know what that figure is. But right now, know that it is way in excess of $2 billion. It is at least $3 billion. We know that for sure. And whatever else may come, you will definitely be reading about it in your favorite organ, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Well, a couple of emails. Alan Elliott wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. I thoroughly enjoy listening to your radio show on PRN. I caught your replay today, 05-18-12, and you read an email from another listener regarding investing in dollars as a safe haven. I don't understand why you would tell someone to invest in the dollar when you are saying our financial system is going to collapse and explaining to people why they should leave the U.S. I keep on hearing from different people like Peter Schiff and the likes saying the dollar will collapse. Also, if you are telling people they should leave the U.S., why do you have offices all throughout Florida? Could you please explain, as I'm confused by your statements? Thank you, Alan Elliott. With pleasure, Alan, and I may say that I touched on this just now in my opening piece before technology intervened so rudely. Don't confuse the economic fortunes of a country with its currency. The United States dollar is not doing well right now because of the increased fortunes of the United States. It's doing well because it happens to be better than the other dross that's out there right now, and that's not saying much, if anything. It also happens to be the currency that people need to buy when they want to do business with the rest of the world for the time being, and it looks like it may stay that way for a while. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why the United States gets so upset when other countries threaten to do business between each other using their local currencies. Because if they don't use the United States, it means they don't lend money to the United States, and therefore the United States can't live on the kindness of strangers anymore. And the United States means business. You know, when they started talking about the Iraqi dinar back in the beginning of the millennium, that's when they decided to attack old Saddam Hussein. That's why they want to attack Iran, because Iran wants to use local currencies to trade oil. And woe betide any country that wants to do business in a country other than, in a currency other than the dollar. For all the Americans saying they want a lower dollar, they want a lower dollar, it's not true. They are lying. They don't want a lower dollar. They want a strong dollar which people will buy and which will enable them to do business with the United States. Because remember, when people borrow dollars, they become marked people, because whatever they do with their dollars, they have to sell them to somebody else, and somebody else has to invest those dollars in the United States. So it is in the United States' interest to have as many foreigners as possible buy these dollars. I mean, you take China, for example, which is said to be selling dollars like crazy right now to whoever they're selling them to, but it doesn't really matter, because whoever they're selling the dollars to has to take the place of China in terms of investments in the United States, for the simple reason there's nothing else they can do with the dollars except invest those dollars in the United States. So, Alan, it doesn't matter about the fortunes of the United States. The dollar, for the time being, is going to be strong. I don't understand why people like Peter Schiff think the dollar will collapse. It's not clear to me. I don't understand their arguments. I read them. I try to interpret them, unravel them, and they still remain a mystery to me. And the other part of your question was why, if we're telling people to leave the U.S., we have offices throughout Florida. The company that I work with is a broker-dealer, and it trades through Fidelity in New York. And many people like myself have representations of the company in different parts of the United States, of which Florida is an integral part because that's where the head office is in Sarasota. No other reason than that. They can advise their clients to go short as much as go long, to bet on the down market as much as to bet on a market which is indicative of a flourishing economy. So that really doesn't have a bearing on whether you feel bullish or bearish or optimistic or pessimistic on the fortunes of the country, Alan. It's simply a means to do some business in the stock market and other markets, other financial markets. So hopefully that's answered your question. I have done justice to it for you, and well, very good. So, now, I have explained before about Keynes and his theories, but for those who are new to the show, it's very important to understand who Keynes was and what he stood for. He was a British economist from the upper classes. His name was John Maynard Keynes. And his concept was very much the socialist one of taking money from thin air and basically increasing government spending when times are bad in order to avoid recessions. That's at the heart of Keynesianism. And really, the West has been run at the top by these Keynesian elites or politicians holding Keynesian ideas ever since 1930. And Keynesian rests on the mantra as follows: government spending overcomes recessions. All else is peripheral. Monetary inflation, graduated taxation, free trade. These peripheral issues will always be sacrificed to the supreme economic premise, government spending overcomes recessions. And that is what Paul Krugman, the economist who writes for the New York Times, that is his own view. It is the opposite of the concept of austerity defined by the financial media universally as cuts in government spending. And I've never seen the word used in any other way over the last 2 years, by the way. Any author who uses that word in any other way owes it to his readers to explain this new usage. And quite honestly, if austerity is the great evil, then the implication is inescapable. That which restores government spending and therefore overcomes austerity is positive. And there is, by the way, another opposing economic philosophy to Keynesianism called Austrianism, and it comes from an economic theory originally emanating from Austria, which says that reducing taxation increases liberty, and liberty is necessary for economic growth. So if a contemporary government cannot reduce taxes without going bankrupt, then it must cut spending if it chooses not to go bankrupt. Europe's national governments are all going bankrupt, and so, by the way, is Japan's and America's. So the solution must be to cut taxes and cut spending even more. Not more government spending, less government spending. You don't want larger government deficits. You need reduced government deficits. And the same goes for taxes. You need lower taxes, not higher taxes. You know, you don't want fiat money either. You need reduced fiat money. All of these things that are called for by the people who want to expand debt are going to hobble the system and make it that much harder for the system to recover. I would have thought that's kind of obvious. But that's what you see. You see it again and again, and it's what caused the stock market to soar largely, you know, 100% when it should have basically gone down, because these people were engaged in policies which are suicidal to the system. You know, the fundamental question really is, why did these elites push their respected economies into the supposed death spiral? Why would these faithful Keynesian elites do such a thing? You know, the Keynesian central bank pushed Europe's economies into a boom from 2001 to 2007. The voters loved it. Interest rates were low. There was lots of money to buy houses. The economies of the South, the Club Med countries, were booming. So was the honorary member of the Club Med, Ireland. Ireland's property values quadrupled. It was all going to last forever. The elites, especially the economists, issued no warnings, except, of course, for the Austrian economists, who were dismissed, as always, as dinosaurs. Then came the bust phase. What the European Central Bank did before 2007 was to inflate. It has done more aggressively ever since 2008. Governments ran even larger deficits. They all implemented Keynesian stimuli. This didn't work. Europe is falling back into a recession. In the spring of 2010, investors in northern Europe caught on to the fact that Club Med residents couldn't compete economically. They kept running deficits with the north. These easygoing populations were living on money borrowed from the north. So were their governments. They had no intention of ever paying back these loans. And why not? You see, this is what Keynesianism teaches. Government loans will not be paid off, ever. Government debt will grow. So will prosperity. 2 years ago, Greece's Socialist Party found out just how far in the debt hole the government was. Interest rates then started to rise in pigs' nations. Pigs' governments were trapped. They couldn't run ever large deficits because the cost of loans were rising. That was when the reality of Keynesianism hit. Deficits do matter. Money is not free. Debts must be rolled over at market interest rates. The horror! That was when governments in the South started cutting back on spending. Not much, you understand. The deficits are still unprecedented, above 6% of GDP. Oh, Keynesians labeled this austerity. It is not austerity. There is no austerity anywhere, even in Greece. It is deficit spending on a massive scale. Austerity is where national governments run surpluses and use excess revenues to pay down the national debt. There hasn't been austerity in Europe since about 1914. The gold coin standard enforced austerity, 1815 to 1914. That was its chief function and its great service to mankind. It kept the West's governments austere. This enabled the private sector to dine at an ever-expanding feast. Keynesians hate the gold coin standard. That's because they believe that high government spending is the basis of high consumer spending, and consumer spending, not private thrift, is the foundation of prosperity. The public, which prefers consumer spending to the austerity of thrift, cheers on the politics of Keynesianism. Deficits without end, borrowing without pain, growth without ceasing. Keynesians promise, and voters believe. But the day of reckoning arrived in 2010. The free money got expensive. The party didn't stop, but some of the guests were sent home to join the adults who have sat and watched TV because there are no jobs. The public feels betrayed. Voters believed in the Keynesian dream. When the target of this challenge refused to rise to the bait, the Keynesians went looking for other takers. In the second half of the 20th century, they found them, lots of them, millions of them. Politicians promised to accomplish the feat. Voters applauded. But times have changed. Unfortunately for Europe and the world right now, there are no pro-growth candidates and or parties on the continent to offer relief from the austerity programs that are grinding their economies to dust. With no one to vote for, all that European electorates have been able to do is to vote against. They have sought to register their protest by defeating incumbents. The incumbents overpromised. They had long told the voters that deficits didn't matter. Deficits didn't matter for as long as banks in Northern Europe kept lending to pigs at rates associated with German frugality. But then came reality. Europe as a whole is in recession, with Greece, Spain, and Portugal in depressions. What are the people supposed to do if the economic chefs on both political left and the political right are offering the same poisonous austerity menu? Balanced budgets remain mirages as far as the eye can see. Token spending cuts, which have made in the name of reducing deficits to about 3% of GDP in 10 years, are part of a poisonous austerity menu. Put in a more familiar terminology, there are too many stones and not enough bread. The voters will not tolerate this. The reason why there are no economic chefs promoting growth is simple. Somebody has to bankroll the growth of government spending. Who will that be? Who wants to trust pigs? The louder the voters scream about austerity, the fewer the number of lenders, meaning lenders at rates under 10%. Austerity, as currently practiced in Europe, is based upon the Keynesian belief that tax increases and government spending cuts have the same effect upon both the government deficit and the economy. In fact, the most virulent strains of Keynesianism cause people to believe that raising top marginal tax rates and increasing government spending can actually boost GDP because the rich have a higher marginal propensity to save than do the recipients of government handouts. François Hollande, the winner of Sunday's election in France 2 weeks ago, is a Keynesian. He believes that raising France's top marginal tax rate to 75% while hiring 60,000 more unionized teachers will make things better. Excuse me? What does an avowed socialist politician have to do with Keynesianism? Keynesianism is what Paul Krugman proclaims, which is greater deficit spending plus sufficient central bank money expansion to finance this expansion. Which Keynesian economist or politician has come out forthrightly for spending cuts, i.e. austerity? Austrian economists have. Ron Paul has. This is why Austrians and Ron Paul have been marginalized by the Keynesian media as cranks. To a leader whose mind is infected by Keynesianism, it makes sense to try to close a budget deficit with a combination of tax increases and spending cuts, with the balance between them determined by some combination of political considerations and so-called fairness. There are many politicians in Europe who have imposed taxes on the rich. The voters have cheered them on, as always. The voters are outraged by the spending cuts. Spending cuts reduce the flow of funds to government bureaucrats and welfare state clients. This is why Greek union members riot. Traditional Keynesianism calls for increased spending, more borrowing, and, if private lenders demand high rates of interest, monetary expansion by the central bank to purchase government debt. And that is the problem, ladies and gentlemen. The problem is that when you spend money you don't have, on an economy which appears to be flourishing, which of course is not flourishing because spending debt money is not spending into a healthy economy, it's spending into a bubble. When that bubble bursts, then you have to take all that money back. That is pretty much the end of a civilization. And those of you who have subscribed to my emails and have seen the charts of the amount of increase in debt in the last 20 years, when you understand how that chart will have to go all the way back down again, you will understand how all of the expenses involved in creating that debt will have to be eliminated. That all the things that people were buying through money which didn't exist will have to forego those things as the money which didn't exist gets taken away. Now, that's a hard concept to understand, taking away money which doesn't exist. But I can assure you, it is a very, very painful process. To some extent, it happened in Germany in the 1920s, but that has nothing on what is going to happen to the West, and in particular the United States and Britain, in the coming years ahead. It is so incredibly Armageddon-like that words fail in order to express how deeply this is going to hurt. And that's why I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that you need to leave the United States, because the United States is going to be impossible to live in the years to come. Well, we've come to the end of the show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry about all the glitches. I will be back with you again on Friday. Until then, have a wonderful week. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye for now.